hush. I made a further minute search, noted that it was now 4:15, and that therefore it would soon be growing light, and then went back to the kitchen regions. To my utter amazement, Poirot was now standing right inside the coal bin, to the utter ruin of his neat light suit. He made a grimace. "But yes, my friend, it is against all my instincts to so ruin my appearance, but what will you?" "But Lavington couldn't have buried it under the coal." "If you would use your eyes, you would see that it is not the coal that I examine." I then saw, on a shelf behind the coal bunker, some logs of wood were piled. Poirot was dexterously taking them down one by one. Suddenly, he uttered a low exclamation. "Your knife, Hastings!" I handed it to him. He appeared to insert it in the wood, and suddenly the logs split in two. It had been neatly sawn in half, and a cavity hollowed out in the centre. From this cavity, Poirot took a little wooden box of Chinese make. "Well done," I cried, carried out of myself. "Gently, Hastings, do not raise your voice too much. Come, let us be off before the daylight is upon us." Slipping the box into his pocket, he leapt lightly out of the coal bunker, brushed himself down as well as he could, and leaving the house by the same way as we had come, we walked rapidly in the direction of London. "But what an extraordinary place," I expostulated. "Anyone might have used the log." "In July, Hastings? And it was at the bottom of the pile. A very ingenious hiding place. Ah, here is a taxi. Now for home, a wash, and a refreshing sleep." After the excitement of the night, I slept late. When I finally strolled into our sitting room just before 1 o'clock, I was surprised to see Poirot leaning back in an armchair, the Chinese box open beside him, calmly reading the letter he had taken from it. He smiled at me affectionately and tapped the sheet he held. "She was right, the Lady Millicent. Never would the Duke have pardoned this letter. It contains some of the most extravagant terms of affection I have ever come across." "Oh, really, Poirot?" I said rather disgustedly. "I don't think you should have read the letter. That sort of thing just isn't done." "It is done by Hercule Poirot," replied my friend imperturbably. "And another thing," I said. "I don't think using Jap's official card yesterday was quite playing the game." "But I was not playing a game, Hastings. I was conducting a case." I shrugged my shoulders. "One can't argue with a point of view." "A step on the stairs," said Poirot. "That will be Lady Millicent." Our fair client came in with an anxious expression on her face, which changed to one of delight on seeing the letter and box which Poirot held up.
"Oh, Monsieur Poirot, how wonderful of you! How did you do it?"
"By rather reprehensible methods, milady. But Mr. Lavington will not prosecute. This is your letter, is it not?" She glanced through it.
"Yes. Oh, how can I ever thank you? You are a wonderful, wonderful man. Where was it hidden?"
Poirot told her.
"How very clever of you."
She took up the small box from the table. "I shall keep this as a souvenir."
"I had hoped, my lady, that you would permit me to keep it, also as a souvenir."
"I hope to send you a better souvenir than that on my wedding day. You shall not find me ungrateful, Monsieur Poirot. The pleasure of doing you a service will be more to me than a check. So you permit that I retain the box."
"Oh, no, Monsieur Poirot, I simply must have that," she cried laughingly.
She stretched out her hand, but Poirot was before her. His hand closed over it.
"I think not."
His voice had changed.
"What do you mean?"
Her voice seemed to have grown sharper. "At any rate, permit me to abstract its further contents. You observed that the original cavity has been reduced by half. In the top half, the compromising letter. In the bottom..." He made a nimble gesture, then held out his hand. On the palm were four large, glittering stones, and two big milky white pearls.
"The jewels stolen in Bond Street the other day, I rather fancy," murmured Poirot. "Jap will tell us."
To my utter amazement, Jap himself stepped out from Poirot's bedroom.
"An old friend of yours, I believe," said Poirot politely to Lady Millicent. "Nabbed, by the Lord," said Lady Millicent, with a complete change of manner. "You nippy old devil!"
She looked at Poirot with almost affectionate awe.
"Well, Gertie, my dear," said Jap, "the game's up this time, I fancy.
Fancy seeing you again so soon. We've got your pal, too, the gentleman who called here the other day, calling himself Lavington. As for Lavington himself, alias Croker, alias Reed, I wonder which of the gang it was who stuck a knife into him the other day in Holland. Thought he'd got the goods with him, didn't you? And he hadn't. He double-crossed you properly, hit him in his own house. You had two fellows looking for them, and then you tackled Monsieur Poirot here, and by a piece of amazing luck, he found them.
You do like talking, don't you? Said the late Lady Millicent.
Easy there now, I'll go quietly. You can't say that I'm not the perfect lady. Ta-da all!
The shoes were wrong, said Poirot dreamily, while I was still too stupefied to speak. I have made my little observations of your English nation, and a lady, a born lady, is always particular about her shoes. She may have shabby clothes, but she will be well shod. Now, this Lady Millicent had smart, expensive clothes and cheap shoes. It was not likely that either you or I should have seen the real Lady Millicent. She has been very little in London, and this girl had a certain superficial resemblance which would pass well enough. As I say, the shoes first awakened my suspicions, and then her story and her veil were a little melodramatic, eh? The Chinese box with a bogus, compromising letter in the top must have been known to all the gang, but the log of wood was the late Mr. Lavington's idea. Par exemple, Hastings, I hope you will not again wound my feelings as you did yesterday by saying that I am unknown to the criminal classes. Ma foi! They even employ me when they themselves fail.
The Lost Mine. I laid down my bankbook with a sigh. It's a curious thing, I observed, but my overdraft never seems to grow any less.
And it perturbs you not. Me, if I had an overdraft, never should I close my eyes all night, declared Poirot.
Well, you deal in comfortable balances, I suppose, I retorted.
£444.04, said Poirot, with some complacency. A neat figure, is it not?
It must be tact on the part of your bank manager. He is evidently acquainted with your passion for symmetrical details. What about investing, say, 300 of it, in the Porcupine oil fields? Their prospectus, which is advertised in the papers today, says that they will pay 100% dividends next year.
Not for me, said Poirot, shaking his head. I like not the sensational. For me, the safe, the prudent investment. Les rentes, the consols, the, how do you call it, the conversion.
Have you never made a speculative investment?
No, mon ami, replied Poirot severely, I have not. And the only shares I own which have not what you call the gilded edge are 14,000 shares in the Burma Mines Limited.
Poirot paused with an air of waiting to be encouraged to go on.
Yes, I prompted.
And for them I paid no cash.
No, they were the reward of the exercise of my little grey cells.
You would like to hear the story, yes?
Well, of course I would.
These mines are situated in the interior of Burma, about 200 miles inland from Rangoon. They were discovered by the Chinese in the 15th century, and worked down to the time of the Mohammedan rebellion, being finally abandoned in the year 1868. The Chinese extracted the rich lead-silver ore from the upper part of the ore body, smelting it for the silver alone, and leaving large quantities of rich lead-bearing slag. This, of course, was soon discovered when prospecting work was carried out in Burma, but owing to the fact that the old workings had become full of loose filling and water, all attempts to find the source of the ore proved fruitless. Many parties were sent out by syndicates, and they dug over a large area, but this rich prize still eluded them. But a representative of one of the syndicates got on the track of a Chinese family who was supposed to have still kept a record of the situation of the mine. The present head of the family was one Wu Ling. What a fascinating page of commercial romance, I exclaimed. Is it not?
Ah, mon ami, one can have romance without golden-haired girls of matchless beauty.
No, no, I am wrong. It is auburn hair that so excites you always. You remember—get on with the story, I said hastily.
Eh bien.
My friend, this Wu Ling, was approached. He was an estimable merchant, much respected in the province where he lived. He admitted at once that he owned the documents in question, and was perfectly prepared to negotiate for this sale. But he objected to dealing with anyone other than principals. Finally, it was arranged that he should journey to England and meet the directors of an important company. Wu Ling made the journey to England on the SS Assunta, and the Assunta docked at Southampton on a cold, foggy morning in November. One of the directors, Mr. Pearson, went down to Southampton to meet the boat, but owing to the fog, the train down was very much delayed, and by the time he arrived, Wu Ling had disembarked and left by special train for London. Mr. Pearson returned to town somewhat annoyed, as he had no idea where the Chinaman proposed to stay. Later in the day, however, the offices of the company were rung up on the telephone. Wu Ling was staying at the Russell Square Hotel. He was feeling somewhat unwell after the voyage, but declared himself perfectly able to attend the board meeting on the following day. The meeting of the board took place at 11 o'clock. When 11:30 came and Wu Ling had not put in an appearance, the secretary rang up the Russell Hotel. In answer to his inquiries, he was told that the Chinaman had gone out with a friend at 10:30. It seemed clear that he had started out with the intention of coming to the meeting, but the morning wore away and he did not appear. It was, of course, possible that he had lost his way, being unacquainted with London, but at a late hour that night he had not returned to the hotel. Thoroughly alarmed now, Mr. Pearson put matters in the hands of the police. On the following day there was still no trace of the missing man, but towards the evening of the day after that again, a body was found in the Thames, which proved to be that of the ill-fated Chinaman. Neither on the body nor in the luggage at the hotel was there any trace of the papers relating to the mine. At this juncture, mon ami, I was brought into the affair. Mr. Pearson called upon me. While profoundly shocked by the death of Wu Ling, his chief anxiety was to recover the papers which were the object of the Chinaman's visit to England. The main anxiety of the police, of course, would be to track down the murderer. The recovery of the papers would be a secondary consideration. What he wanted me to do was to cooperate with the police while acting in the interests of the company. I consented readily enough. It was clear that there were two fields of search open to me. On the one hand, I might look among the employees of the company who knew of the Chinaman's coming. On the other, among the passengers on the boat who might have been acquainted with his mission. I started with the second, as being a narrower field of search. In this, I coincided with Inspector Miller, who was in charge of the case, a man altogether different from our friend Jap. Conceited, ill-mannered, and quite insufferable. Together, we interviewed the officers of the ship. They had little to tell us. Wu Ling had kept much to himself on the voyage. He had been intimate with but two of the other passengers. One, a broken-down European named Dyer, who appeared to bear a somewhat unsavory reputation. The other, a young bank clerk named Charles Lester, who was returning from Hong Kong. We were lucky enough to obtain snapshots of both these men. At the moment, there seemed little doubt that if either of the two was implicated, Dyer was the man. He was known to be mixed up with a gang of Chinese crooks and was altogether a most likely suspect. Our next step was to visit the Russell Square Hotel. Shown a snapshot of Wu Ling, they recognized him at once. We then showed them the snapshot of Dyer. But to our disappointment, the hall porter declared positively that that was not the man who had come to the hotel on the fatal morning. Almost as an afterthought, I produced the photograph of Lester, and to my surprise, the man at once recognized it. "Yes, sir," he asserted. "That's the gentleman who came in at 10:30 and asked for Mr. Wu Ling, and afterwards went out with him." The affair was progressing. Our next move was to interview Mr. Charles Lester. He met us with the utmost frankness, was desolated to hear of the Chinaman's untimely death, and put himself at our disposal in every way. His story was as follows. By arrangement with Wu Ling, he called for him at the hotel at 10:30. Wu Ling, however, did not appear. Instead, his servant came,
explained that his master had had to go out, and offered to conduct the young man to where his master now was. Suspecting nothing, Lester agreed, and the Chinaman procured a taxi. They drove for some time in the direction of the docks. Suddenly becoming mistrustful, Lester stopped the taxi and got out, disregarding the servant's protests. That, he assured us, was all he knew. Apparently satisfied, we thanked him and took our leave. His story was soon proved to be a somewhat inaccurate one. To begin with, Wu Ling had had no servant with him, either on the boat or at the hotel. In the second place, the taxi driver who had driven the two men on that morning came forward. Far from Lester's having left the taxi en route, he and the Chinese gentleman had driven to a certain unsavory dwelling place in Limehouse, right in the heart of Chinatown. The place in question was more or less well known as an opium den of the lowest description. The two gentlemen had gone in. About an hour later, the English gentleman, whom he identified from the photograph, came out alone. He looked very pale and ill, and directed the taxi man to take him to the nearest underground station. Inquiries were made about Charles Lester's standing, and it was found that, though bearing an excellent character, he was heavily in debt and had a secret passion for gambling. Dyer, of course, was not lost sight of. It seemed just faintly possible that he might have impersonated the other man. But that idea was proved utterly groundless. His alibi for the whole day in question was absolutely unimpeachable. Of course, the proprietor of the opium den denied everything with oriental stolidity. He had never seen Charles Lester. No two gentlemen had been to the place that morning. In any case, the police were wrong. No opium was ever smoked there. His denials, however well meant, did little to help Charles Lester. He was arrested for the murder of Wu Ling. A search of his effects was made, but no papers relating to the mine were discovered. The proprietor of the opium den was also taken into custody, but a cursory raid of his premises yielded nothing. Not even a stick of opium rewarded the zeal of the police. In the meantime, my friend Mr. Pearson was in a great state of agitation. He strode up and down my room uttering great lamentations. But you must have some ideas, Monsieur Poirot, he kept urging. Surely you must have some ideas. Well, certainly, I have ideas, I replied cautiously. That is the trouble. One has too many. Therefore they all lead in different directions. For instance, he suggested. For instance, the taxi driver. We have only his word for it that he drove the two men to that house. That is one idea. Then, was it really that house that they went to? Supposing that they left the taxi there, passed through the house and out by another entrance, and went elsewhere. Mr. Pearson seemed struck by that. But you do nothing but sit and think. Can't we do something? He was of an impatient temperament, you comprehend. Monsieur, I said with dignity, it is not for Hercule Poirot to run up and down the evil-smelling streets of Limehouse like a little dog of no breeding. Be calm. My agents are at work. On the following day, I had news for him. The two men had indeed passed through the house in question, but their real objective was a small eating house close to the river. They were seen to pass in there, and Lester came out alone. And then figure to yourself, Hastings, an idea of the most unreasonable seized this Mr. Pearson. Nothing would suit him but that we should go ourselves to this eating house and make investigations. I argued and prayed, but he would not listen. He talked of disguising himself. He even suggested that I should shave off my mustache. Yes, rien que ça. I pointed out to him that it was an idea ridiculous and absurd. One destroys not a thing of beauty wantonly. Besides, shall not a Belgian gentleman with a moustache desire to see life and smoke opium just as readily as one without a moustache? Eh bien, he gave in on that, but he still insisted on his project. He turned up that evening. Mon Dieu, what a figure! He wore what he called the pea jacket. His chin, it was dirty and unshaved. He had a scarf of the vilest that offended the nose, and figure to yourself, he was enjoying himself. Truly, the English are mad.
He made some changes in my own appearance. I permitted it. Can one argue with a maniac? We started out. After all, could I let him go alone, a child dressed up to act the charades? Well, of course you couldn't, I replied. To continue. We arrived. Mr. Pearson talked English of the strangest. He represented himself to me a man of the sea. He talked of lubbers and fuxels and I know not what. It was a low little room with many Chinese in it. We ate of peculiar dishes. Adieu, mon estomac. Poirot clasped that portion of his anatomy before continuing. Then there came to us the proprietor, a Chinaman with a face of evil smiles. You gentlemen no likey food here, he said. You come for what you likey better, peacey pipe, huh? Mr. Pearson, he gave me the great kick under the table. He had on the boots of the sea, too. And he said, I don't mind if I do, John. Lead ahead. The Chinaman smiled, and he took us through a door, and to a cellar, and through a trapdoor, and down some steps, and up again into a room all full of divans and cushions of the most comfortable. We lay down, and the Chinese boy took off our boots. It was the best moment of the evening. Then they brought us the opium pipes, and cooked the opium pills, and we pretended to smoke and then to sleep and dream. But when we were alone, Mr. Pearson called softly to me, and immediately he began to crawl along the floor. He went into another room where other people were asleep, and so on, until we heard two men talking. We stayed behind a curtain and listened. They were speaking of Wu Ling. What about the papers? Said one. Mr. Lester, he takey those, answered the other, who was a Chinaman. He say, putty them all in a safey place, where policeman no looky. Ah, but he is nabbed, said the first one. He gets free. Policeman not sure he done it. There was more of the same kind of thing. Then, apparently, the two men were coming our way, and we scuttled back to our beds. We'd better get out of here, said Pearson, after a few minutes had elapsed. This place isn't healthy. You are right, monsieur, I agreed. We have played the farce long enough. We succeeded in getting away all right, paying handsomely for our smoke. Once clear of Limehouse, Pearson drew a long breath. I'm glad to get out of that, he said, but it's something, to be sure. It is indeed, I agreed, and I fancy that we shall not have much difficulty in finding what we want after this evening's masquerade. And there was no difficulty whatsoever, finished Poirot suddenly. This abrupt ending seemed so extraordinary that I stared at him. But where were they? I asked. In his pocket, tout simplement. But in whose pocket? Mr. Pearson's, parbleu. Then, observing my look of bewilderment, he continued gently, You do not see it yet. Mr. Pearson, like Charles Lester, was in debt. Mr. Pearson, like Charles Lester, was fond of gambling, and he conceived the idea of stealing the papers from the Chinaman. He met him, all right, at Southampton, came up to London with him, and took him straight to Limehouse. It was foggy that day. The Chinaman would not notice where he was going. I fancy Mr. Pearson smoked the opium fairly often down there, and had some peculiar friends in consequence. I do not think he meant murder. His idea was that one of the Chinamen should impersonate Wu Ling and receive the money for the sale of the document. So far so good. But to the Oriental mind it was infinitely simpler to kill Wu Ling and throw his body into the river. And Pearson's Chinese accomplices followed their own methods without consulting him. Imagine, then, what you would call the funk bleu of Monsieur Pearson. Someone may have seen him in the train with Wu Ling. Murder is a very different thing from simple abduction. His salvation lies with the Chinaman, who is impersonating Wu Ling at the Russell Square Hotel. If only the body is not discovered too soon. Probably Wu Ling had told him of the arrangement between him and Charles Lester, whereby the latter was to call for him at the hotel. Pearson sees there an excellent way of diverting suspicion from himself. Charles Lester shall be the last person to be seen in company with Wu Ling. The impersonator has orders to represent himself to Lester as the servant of Wu Ling and to bring him as speedily as possible to Limehouse. There, very likely, he was offered a drink. The drink would be suitably drugged,
and when Lester emerged an hour later, he would have a very hazy impression of what had happened. So much was this the case that as soon as Lester learned of Wu Ling's death, he loses his nerve and denies that he ever reached Limehouse. By that, of course, he plays right into Pearson's hands. But is Pearson content? No. My manner disquiets him, and he determines to complete the case against Lester. So he arranges an elaborate masquerade. Me, I am to be gulled completely. Did I not say just now that he was as a child acting the charades? Eh bien, I play my part. He goes home rejoicing, but in the morning Inspector Miller arrives on his doorstep. The papers are found on him. The game is up. Bitterly he regrets permitting himself to play the farce with Hercule Poirot. There was only one real difficulty in the affair. Oh, what was that? I demanded curiously. Convincing Inspector Miller. What an animal that, both obstinate and imbecile. And in the end he took all the credit. Too bad, I cried. Ah, well, I had my compensations. The other directors of the Burma Mines Limited awarded me 14,000 shares as a small recompense for my services. Not so bad, eh? But when investing money, keep, I beg of you, Hastings, strictly to the conservative. The things you read in the paper, they may not be true. The directors of the Porcupine, they may be so many Mr. Pearsons. The Chocolate Box. It was a wild night. Outside, the wind howled malevolently, and the rain beat against the windows in great gusts. Poirot and I sat facing the hearth, our legs stretched out to the cheerful blaze. Between us was a small table. On my side of it stood some carefully brewed hot toddy. On Poirot's was a cup of thick, rich chocolate, which I would not have drunk for £100. Poirot sipped the thick brown mess in the pink china cup and sighed with contentment. "Quelle belle vie," he murmured. "Yes, it's a good old world," I agreed. "Here I am with a job, and a good job, too. And here are you, famous." "Oh, mon ami," protested Poirot. "But you are, and rightly so. When I think back on your long line of successes, I'm positively amazed. I don't believe you know what failure is." "He would be a droll kind of original who could say that." "No, but seriously, have you ever failed?"
"Innumerable times, my friend."
"What would you? La bonne chance, it cannot always be on your side. I have been called in too late. Very often, another, working towards the same goal, has arrived there first. Twice I have been stricken down with the illness just as I was on the point of success. One must take the downs with the ups, my friend."
"Well, I didn't quite mean that," I said. "I mean, have you ever been completely down and out over a case through your own fault?"
"Ah, I comprehend. You ask if I have ever made the complete prize ass of myself, as you say over here." "Once, my friend." A slow, reflective smile hovered over his face. "Yes, once I made a fool of myself." He sat up suddenly in his chair. "See here, my friend, you have, I know, kept a record of my little successes. You should add one more story to the collection. The story of a failure." He leaned forward and placed a log on the fire. Then, after carefully wiping his hands on a little duster that hung on a nail by the fireplace, he leaned back and commenced his story.
"That of which I tell you," said Monsieur Poirot, "took place in Belgium many years ago. It was at the time of the terrible struggle in France between church and state. Monsieur Paul Deroulard was a French deputy of note. It was an open secret that the portfolio of a minister awaited him. He was among the bitterest of the anti-Catholic party, and it was certain that on his accession to power he would have to face violent enmity. He was in many ways a peculiar man. Though he neither drank nor smoked, he was nevertheless not so scrupulous in other ways. You comprehend, Hastings?
C'était des femmes, toujours des femmes.
He had married some years earlier a young lady from Brussels who had brought him a substantial dot. Undoubtedly, the money was useful to him in his career, as his family was not rich, though, on the other hand, He was entitled to call himself Monsieur le Baron if he chose. There were no children of the marriage, and his wife died after 2 years, the result of a fall downstairs. Among the property which she bequeathed to him was a house on the Avenue Louise in Brussels. It was in this house that his sudden death took place. The event coincided with the resignation of the minister whose portfolio he was to inherit. All the papers printed long notices of his career. His death, which had taken place quite suddenly in the evening after dinner, was attributed to heart failure. At that time, mon ami, I was, as you know, a member of the Belgian detective force. The death of Monsieur Paul Déroulard was not particularly interesting to me. I am, as you know, bon catholique, and his demise seemed to me fortunate. It was some 3 days afterwards, when my vacation had just begun, that I received a visit at my own apartments, a lady, heavily veiled, but evidently quite young, and I perceived at once that she was a jeune fille tout à fait comme il faut. "You are Monsieur Hercule Poirot?" she asked in a low, sweet voice. I bowed. "Of the detective service." Again I bowed. "Be seated, I pray of you, mademoiselle," I said. She accepted a chair and drew aside her veil. Her face was charming, though marred with tears, and haunted as though with some poignant anxiety. "Monsieur," she said, "I understand that you are now taking a vacation. Therefore you will be free to take up a private case. You understand that I do not wish to call in the police." I shook my head. "I fear what you ask is impossible, mademoiselle, even though on vacation I am still of the police." She leaned forward. "Écoutez, monsieur. All that I ask of you is to investigate. The result of your investigations, you are at perfect liberty to report to the police. If what I believe to be true is true, we shall need all the machinery of the law." That placed a somewhat different complexion on the matter, and I placed myself at her service without more ado. A slight color rose in her cheeks. "I thank you, monsieur. It is the death of Monsieur Paul Déroulard that I ask you to investigate." "Comment?" I exclaimed, surprised. "Monsieur, I have nothing to go upon, nothing but my woman's instinct, but I am convinced, convinced, I tell you, that Monsieur Déroulard did not die a natural death." "But surely the doctors, doctors may be mistaken. He was so robust, so strong. Ah, Monsieur Poirot, I beseech of you to help me." The poor child was almost beside herself. She would have knelt to me. I soothed her as best I could. "I will help you, mademoiselle. I feel almost sure that your fears are unfounded, but we will see. First, I will ask you to describe to me the inmates of the house." "There are the domestics, of course. Jeannette, Felice, and Denise, the cook. She has been there many years. The others are simple country girls. Also there is François, but he too is an old servant. Then there is Monsieur Déroulard's mother, who lived with him, and myself. My name is Virginie Ménard. I am a poor cousin of the late Madame Déroulard, Monsieur Paul's wife, and I have been a member of their ménage for over 3 years. I have now described to you the household. There were also 2 guests staying at the house." "And they were?" "Monsieur de Saint-Hilaire, a neighbor of Monsieur Déroulard in France. Also an English friend, Mr. John Wilson." "Are they still with you?" "Mr. Wilson, yes, but Monsieur de Saint-Hilaire departed yesterday." "And what is your plan, Mademoiselle Ménard? If you will present yourself at the house in 30 minutes' time, I will have arranged some story to account for your presence. I had better represent you to be connected with journalism in some way. I shall say you have come from Paris, and that you have brought a card of introduction from Monsieur de Saint-Hilaire. Madame Déroulard is very feeble in health and will pay little attention to details." On Mademoiselle's ingenious pretext, I was admitted to the house, and after a brief interview with the dead deputy's mother, who was a wonderfully imposing and aristocratic figure, though obviously in failing health, I was made free of the premises. "I wonder, my friend," continued Poirot, "whether you can possibly figure to yourself the difficulties of my task. Here was a man whose death had taken place 3 days previously. If there had been foul play, only one possibility was admittable. Poison. And I had no chance of seeing the body. And there was no possibility of examining or analyzing any medium in which the poison could have been administered. There were no clues, false or otherwise, to consider. Had the man been poisoned? Had he died a natural death? I, Hercule Poirot, with nothing to help me, had to decide. First, I interviewed the domestics, and with their aid, I recapitulated the evening. I paid especial notice to the food at dinner and the method of serving it. The soup had been served by Monsieur Deroulard himself from a tureen. Next, a dish of cutlets, then a chicken. Finally, a compote of fruits. And all placed on the table and served by Monsieur himself. The coffee was brought in a big pot to the dinner table. Nothing there, mon ami. Impossible to poison one without poisoning all. After dinner, Madame Deroulard had retired to her own apartments, and Mademoiselle Virginie had accompanied her. The three men had adjourned to Monsieur Deroulard's study. Here they had chatted amicably for some time, when suddenly, without any warning, the deputy had fallen heavily to the ground. Monsieur de Saint-Hilaire had rushed out and told François to fetch the doctor immediately. He said it was without doubt an apoplexy, explained the man. But when the doctor arrived, the patient was past help. Mr. John Wilson, to whom I was presented by Mademoiselle Virginie, was what was known in those days as a regular John Bull Englishman, middle-aged and burly. His account, delivered in very British French, was substantially the same. Deroulard went very red in the face, and down he fell. There was nothing further to be found out there. Next, I went to the scene of the tragedy, the study, and was left alone there at my own request. So far, there was nothing to support Mademoiselle Ménard's theory. I could not but believe that it was a delusion on her part. Evidently, she had entertained a romantic passion for the dead man, which had not permitted her to take a normal view of the case. Nevertheless, I searched the study with meticulous care. It was just possible that a hypodermic needle might have been introduced into the dead man's chair in such a way as to allow of a fatal injection. The minute puncture it would cause was likely to remain unnoticed. But I could discover no sign to support the theory. I flung myself down in the chair with a gesture of despair. "Enfin, I abandon it," I said out loud. "There is not a clue anywhere. Everything is perfectly normal." As I said the words, my eyes fell on a large box of chocolates standing on a table nearby, and my heart gave a leap. It might not be a clue to Monsieur Deroulard's death, but here at least was something that was not normal. I lifted the lid. The box was full, untouched, not a chocolate was missing, but that only made the peculiarity that had caught my eye even more striking. For you see, Hastings, while the box itself was pink, the lid was blue. Now, one often sees a blue ribbon on a pink box and vice versa. But a box of one color and a lid of another? No, decidedly. Ça ne se voit jamais. I did not as yet see that this little incident was of any use to me. Yet I determined to investigate it as being out of the ordinary. I rang the bell for François and asked him if his late master had been fond of sweets. A faint, melancholy smile came to his lips. Passionately fond of them, monsieur. He would always have a box of chocolates in the house. He did not drink wine of any kind, you see. Yet this box has not been touched. I lifted the lid to show him. Pardon, monsieur, but that was a new box, purchased on the day of his death, the other being nearly finished. Then the other box was finished on the day of his death? I said slowly. Yes, monsieur. I found it empty in the morning and threw it away. Did Monsieur Deroulard eat sweets at all hours of the day? Usually after dinner, monsieur. I began to see light. François, I said. You can be discreet? If there is need, monsieur. Bon. Know then that I am of the police. Can you find me that other box? Without doubt, monsieur. It will be in the dustbin. He departed and returned a few minutes later with a dust-covered object. It was the duplicate of the box I held, save for the fact that this time the box was blue and the lid was pink. I thanked François, recommended him once more to be discreet, and left the house in the Avenue Louise without more ado. Next, I called upon the doctor who had attended Monsieur Desroulards. With him I had a difficult task. He entrenched himself prettily behind a wall of learned phraseology, but I fancied that he was not quite as sure about the case as he would like to be. There have been many curious occurrences of the kind, he observed, when I managed to disarm him somewhat. A sudden fit of anger, a violent emotion, after a heavy dinner, c'est entendu. Then, with an excess of rage, the blood flies to the head and, pfft, there you are. But Monsieur Desroulards had had no violent emotion, no? I ascertained that he had been having a stormy altercation with Monsieur de Saint-Hilaire. Why should he? C'est évident. The doctor shrugged his shoulders. Was not Monsieur de Saint-Hilaire a Catholic of the most fanatical? Their friendship was being ruined by this question of church and state. Not a day passed without discussions. To Monsieur de Saint-Hilaire, Desroulards appeared almost as Antichrist. This was unexpected, and gave me food for thought. One more question, Doctor. Would it be possible to introduce a fatal dose of poison into a chocolate? It would be possible, I suppose, said the doctor slowly. Pure prussic acid would meet the case if there were no chance of evaporation, and a tiny globule of anything might be swallowed unnoticed. But it does not seem a very likely supposition. A chocolate full of morphine or strychnine? He made a wry face. You comprehend, Monsieur Poirot. One bite would be enough. The unwary one would not stand upon ceremony. Thank you, Monsieur le Docteur. I withdrew. Next, I made inquiries of the chemists, especially those in the neighborhood of the Avenue Louise. It is good to be of the police. I got the information I wanted without any trouble. Only in one case could I hear of any poison having been supplied to the house in question. This was some eye drops of atropine sulfate for Madame Desroulards. Atropine is a potent poison, and for the moment I was elated. But the symptoms of atropine poisoning are closely allied to those of ptomaine, and bear no resemblance to those I was studying. Besides, the prescription was an old one. Madame Desroulards had suffered from cataracts in both eyes for many years. I was turning away discouraged when the chemist's voice called me back. Un moment, Monsieur Poirot. I remember the girl who brought that prescription. She said something about having to go on to the English chemist. You might try there. I did. Once more enforcing my official status, I got the information I wanted. On the day before Monsieur Desroulards' death, they had made up a prescription for Mr. John Wilson. Not that there was any making up about it. They were simply little tablets of trinitrine. I asked if I might see some. He showed me them, and my heart beat faster, for the tiny tablets were of chocolate. Is it a poison? I asked. No, monsieur. Can you describe to me its effect? It lowers the blood pressure. It is given for some forms of heart trouble, angina pectoris, for instance. It relieves the arterial tension, in arteriosclerosis. I interrupted him. Ma foi! This rigmarole says nothing to me. Does it cause the face to flush? Oh, certainly it does. And supposing I ate 10 or 20 of your little tablets, what then? I should not advise you to attempt it, he replied dryly. And yet you say it is not poison. There are many things not called poison which can kill a man, he replied as before. I left the shop elated. At last things had begun to march. I now knew that John Wilson had the means for the crime. But what about the motive? He had come to Belgium on business and had asked Monsieur Desroulards, whom he knew slightly, to put him up. There was apparently no way in which Desroulards' death could benefit him. Moreover, I discovered by inquiries in England that he had suffered for some years from that painful form of heart disease known as angina. Therefore, he had a genuine right to have those tablets in his possession. Nevertheless, I was convinced that someone had gone to the chocolate box, opening the full one first by mistake, and had abstracted the contents of the last chocolate, cramming in instead as many little trinitrine tablets as it would hold. The chocolates were large ones. Between 20 or 30 tablets, I felt sure, could have been inserted.
But who had done this? There were two guests in the house. John Wilson had the means. Saint-Hilaire had the motive. Remember, he was a fanatic, and there is no fanatic like a religious fanatic. Could he by any means have got hold of John Wilson's trinitrine? Another little idea came to me. Ah, you smile at my little ideas. Why had Wilson run out of trinitrine? Surely he would bring an adequate supply from England. I called once more at the house in the Avenue Louise. Wilson was out, but I saw the girl who did his room, Felicie. I demanded of her immediately whether it was not true that Monsieur Wilson had lost a bottle from his washstand some little time ago. The girl responded eagerly. It was quite true. She, Felicie, had been blamed for it. The English gentleman had evidently thought that she had broken it and did not like to say so, whereas she had never even touched it. Without doubt, it was Jeannette, always nosing around where she had no business to be. I calmed the flow of words and took my leave. I knew now all that I wanted to know. It remained for me to prove my case. That, I felt, would not be easy. I might be sure that Saint-Hilaire had removed the bottle of trinitrine from John Wilson's washstand, but to convince others, I would have to produce evidence, and I had none to produce. Never mind. I knew that was the great thing. You remember our difficulty in the Stiles case, Hastings? There again, I knew, but it took me a long time to find the last link which made my chain of evidence against the murderer complete. I asked for an interview with Mademoiselle Ménard. She came at once. I demanded of her the address of Monsieur de Saint-Hilaire. A look of trouble came over her face. Why do you want it, monsieur? Mademoiselle, it is necessary. She seemed doubtful, troubled. He can tell you nothing. He is a man whose thoughts are not in this world. He hardly notices what goes on around him. Possibly, mademoiselle. Nevertheless, he was an old friend of Monsieur de Roulard. There may be things he can tell me. Things of the past, old grudges, old love affairs. The girl flushed and bit her lip. As you please, but I feel sure now that I have been mistaken. It was good of you to accede to my demand, but I was upset, almost distraught at the time. I see now that there is no mystery to solve. Leave it. I beg of you, monsieur. I eyed her closely. Mademoiselle, I said, it is sometimes difficult for a dog to find a scent. But once he has found it, nothing on earth will make him leave it. That is, if he is a good dog. And I, mademoiselle, I, Hercule Poirot, am a very good dog. Without a word, she turned away. A few minutes later, she returned with the address written on a sheet of paper. I left the house. François was waiting for me outside. He looked at me anxiously. There is no news, monsieur? None as yet, my friend. Ah! Pauvre Monsieur de Roulard, he sighed. I, too, was of his way of thinking. I do not care for priests. Not that I would say so in the house. The women are all devout. A good thing, perhaps. Madame est très pieuse. Et Mademoiselle Virginie aussi. Mademoiselle Virginie, was she très pieuse? Thinking of the tear-stained, passionate face I had seen that first day, I wondered. Having obtained the address of Monsieur de Saint-Hilaire, I wasted no time. I arrived in the neighborhood of his chateau in the Ardennes, but it was some days before I could find a pretext for gaining admission to the house. In the end, I did. How do you think? As a plumber, mon ami. It was the affair of a moment to arrange a neat little gas leak in his bedroom. I departed for my tools and took care to return with them at an hour when I knew I should have the field pretty much to myself. What I was searching for, I hardly knew. The one thing needful, I could not believe there was any chance of finding. He would never have run the risk of keeping it. Still, when I found the little cupboard above the washstand locked, I could not resist the temptation of seeing what was inside it. The lock was quite a simple one to pick. The door swung open. It was full of old bottles. I took them up one by one with a trembling hand. Suddenly, I uttered a cry. Figure to yourself, my friend. I held in my hand a little phial with an English chemist's label. On it were the words, Trinitrine tablets, one to be taken when required, Mr. John Wilson.
I controlled my emotion, closed the cupboard, slipped the bottle in my pocket, and continued to repair the gas leak. One must be methodical. When I left the chateau and took the train for my own country as soon as possible, I arrived in Brussels late that night. I was writing out the report for the préfet in the morning when a note was brought to me. It was from old Madame de Roulard, and it summoned me to the house in the Avenue Louise without delay. François opened the door for me. Madame la Baronne is awaiting you. He conducted me to her apartments. She sat in state in a large armchair. There was no sign of Mademoiselle Virginie. Monsieur Poirot, said the old lady, I have just learned that you are not what you pretend to be. You are a police officer. That is so, madame. You came here to inquire into the circumstances of my son's death. Again, I replied, that is so, madame. I should be glad if you would tell me what progress you have made. I hesitated. First, I would like to know how you have learned all this, madame. From one who is no longer of this world. Her words, and the brooding way she uttered them, sent a chill to my heart. I was incapable of speech. Therefore, monsieur, I would beg of you most urgently to tell me exactly what progress you have made in your investigation. Madame, my investigation is finished. My son? Was killed deliberately. You know by whom? Yes, madame. Who then? Monsieur de Saint-Hilaire. You are wrong. Monsieur de Saint-Hilaire is incapable of such a crime. The proofs are in my hands. I beg of you once more to tell me all. This time I obeyed, going over each step that had led me to the discovery of the truth. She listened attentively. At the end, she nodded her head. Yes, yes, it is all as you say, all but one thing. It was not Monsieur de Saint-Hilaire who killed my son. It was I, his mother. I stared at her. She continued to nod her head gently. It is well that I sent for you. It is the providence of the good God that Virginie told me before she departed for the convent what she had done. Listen, Monsieur Poirot. My son was an evil man. He persecuted the church. He led a life of mortal sin. He dragged down the other souls beside his own. But there was worse than that. As I came out of my room in this house one morning, I saw my daughter-in-law standing at the head of the stairs. She was reading a letter. I saw my son steal up behind her, one swift push, and she fell, striking her head on the marble steps. When they picked her up, she was dead. My son was a murderer, and only I, his mother, knew it. She closed her eyes for a moment. You cannot conceive, monsieur, of my agony, my despair. What was I to do? Denounce him to the police? I could not bring myself to do it. It was my duty, but my flesh was weak. Besides, would they believe me? My eyesight had been failing for some time. They would say I was mistaken. I kept silence, but my conscience gave me no peace. By keeping silence, I too was a murderer. My son inherited his wife's money. He flourished as the green bay tree. And now he was to have a minister's portfolio. His persecution of the church would be redoubled. And there was Virginie. She, poor child, beautiful, naturally pious, was fascinated by him. He had a strange and terrible power over women. I saw it coming. I was powerless to prevent it. He had no intention of marrying her. The time came when she was ready to yield everything to him. Then I saw my clear path. He was my son. I had given him life. I was responsible for him. He had killed one woman's body. Now he would kill another's soul. I went to Mr. Wilson's room and took the bottle of tablets. He had once said laughingly that there were enough in it to kill a man. I went into the study and opened the big box of chocolates that always stood on the table. I opened a new box by mistake. The other was on the table also. There was just one chocolate left in it. That simplified things. No one ate chocolates except my son and Virginie. I would keep her with me that night. All went as I had planned. She paused, closing her eyes a minute, then opened them again. Monsieur Poirot, I am in your hands. They tell me I have not many days to live.
I am willing to answer for my action before the good God. Must I answer for it on earth also?
I hesitated.
But the empty bottle, madame, I said to gain time. How came that into Monsieur de Saint-Hilaire's possession?
When he came to say goodbye to me, monsieur, I slipped it into his pocket. I did not know how to get rid of it. I am so infirm that I cannot move about much without help, and finding it empty in my rooms might have caused suspicion. You understand, monsieur? She drew herself up to her full height. It was with no idea of casting suspicion on Monsieur de Saint-Hilaire. I never dreamed of such a thing. I thought his valet would find an empty bottle and throw it away without question. I bowed my head.
I comprehend, madame, I said.
And your decision, monsieur?
Her voice was firm and unfaltering, her head held as high as ever. I rose to my feet.
Madame, I said,
I have the honor to wish you good day. I have made my investigations and failed. The matter is closed.
Poirot was silent for a moment and then said quietly,
She died just a week later. Mademoiselle Virginie passed through her novitiate and duly took the veil. That, my friend, is the story. I must admit that I do not make a fine figure in it.
Oh, but that was hardly a failure, I expostulated. What else could you have thought under the circumstances?
Ah, sacré, mon ami, cried Poirot, becoming suddenly animated.
Is it that you do not see? But I was 36 times an idiot. My grey cells, they functioned not at all. The whole time I had the clue in my hands.
What clue?
The chocolate box, do you not see? Would anyone in possession of their full eyesight make such a mistake? I knew Madame de Roulard had cataracts. The atropine drops told me that. There was only one person in the household whose eyesight was such that she could not see which lid to replace. It was the chocolate box that started me on the track, and yet up to the end I failed consistently to perceive its real significance. Also, my psychology was at fault. Had Monsieur de Saint-Hilaire been the criminal, he would never have kept an incriminating bottle. Finding it was a proof of his innocence. I had learned already from Mademoiselle Virginie that he was absent-minded. Altogether, it was a miserable affair that I have recounted to you there. Only to you have I told the story. You comprehend, I do not figure well in it. An old lady commits a crime in such a simple and clever fashion that I, Hercule Poirot, am completely deceived. Sapristi! It does not bear thinking of. Forget it.
Oh, no, remember it. And if you think at any time that I am growing conceited, it is not likely, but it might arise. I concealed a smile.
Eh bien, my friend, you shall say to me, chocolate box. Is it agreed?
It's a bargain.
After all, said Poirot reflectively, it was an experience. I, who have undoubtedly the finest brain in Europe at present, can afford to be magnanimous.
Chocolate box, I murmured gently.
Pardon, mon ami?
I looked at Poirot's innocent face as he bent forward inquiringly, and my heart smote me. I had suffered often at his hands, but I too, though not possessing the finest brain in Europe, could afford to be magnanimous.
Nothing,
I lied, and lit another pipe, smiling to myself.
We hope you have enjoyed Poirot Investigates by Agatha Christie, performed by David Suchet. Poirot Investigates, text copyright 1924, Agatha Christie Limited. Production copyright 1989 and 1990, EMI Records, trading as Music for Pleasure. Published 1999, HarperCollins Publishers Limited. All rights reserved. Thank you for listening.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.